And the World Bank has done quite a bit of work in this area. We're anxious to take advantage of it, because speaking personally, I've been surprised how little information is readily available on this topic. So over to you, Simon.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to the Council about the work that we've been doing on observance of standards and codes in the field of accounting and auditing. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Bradbury. I head up the accounting policy unit at the bank. Let me just run through how I'm going to structure this session. I thought I'd start off just with a little bit of background in terms of the World Bank's interest in IFRS, why we're here, which is connected with a number of different roles that we play in the international financial regulatory architecture. So once I've run through some context and some background, I'll then talk a little bit about the ROSC initiative generally, and then dig down into the accounting and auditing ROSCs in particular, which I think is what everyone's most interested in. And then I will move on to some issues and trends that we're observing from completed reports on observation of standards and codes, and then wrap up with some next steps. So, a philosophical question, why are we here? The bank's interested in IFRS from a number of different perspectives. We're a development organization. There's a well-established body of literature that demonstrates the linkage between high-quality financial reporting, economic development, economic growth, which leads to poverty reduction, which is our core mission. And so with that in mind, we encourage our client countries to adopt IFRS rather than developing their own standards, just as a policy principle. We're also a substantial user of financial statements. I think it's true to say we're one of the biggest consumers of audit products in the world. I think we get through some 5,000 sets of audited financial statements each year. Those are financial statements provided by entities that are implementing World Bank financed operations. Thirdly, we are a preparer. We have a $476 billion balance sheet, a fairly substantial structured bond portfolio. We're a public filer with the SEC under our own regulation. We do report under US GAAP, which is a little bit awkward. As an international organization, we would prefer to report under IFRS, but under IAS 32, we would have to classify our capital as a liability. And our board of directors hasn't shown a great deal of appetite to do that. So if you could fix that standard, that would come in very handy. And then, as I mentioned just before, we play a number of different roles in the international financial regulatory community that I'll touch on in a minute. Here's just a schematic diagram of what I was talking about earlier, the various transmission mechanisms that high-quality financial information makes towards growth and job creation. Internationally, we're represented at various different levels. At a very senior level, the president of the bank attends the G20, the G7, the G8, and the equivalent regional bodies. The chief financial officer of the bank, Vincenzo Lavia, he sits on the Financial Stability Board. I think you're all familiar with Chuck McDonough, who wasn't able to be here this week, unfortunately. Otherwise, he'd be sitting here. He's on the IFRS advisory on this council. He's also on the Integrated International Reporting Committee. He's a member of the IFAC Public Interest Oversight Board. We're represented on the monitoring group for the PIOB. We have observer status at the IPSASB, and we're also we're an observer at the IFIAR group, the International Audit Regulators. So that's just a bit of sort of context and background for the bank's role and why it has an interest in these issues. Moving on now to the ROSC initiative itself. This was launched in the late 90s following the Asian financial crisis. The thinking at the time was this would be an attempt to foresee future financial crises. Probably not, best not getting into a discussion about how successful it was at doing that. It's administered by the IMF. It focuses on three areas: macro policy and data transparency, financial sector regulation and supervision, and market integrity. And what it does across all of those areas is it's summarizing the extent of country compliance with internationally recognized standards and codes, of which there are quite a few. You see them all listed here under the three pillars that I mentioned. I won't go through all of these in detail. You've got them in your slides. But if you look over in the right-hand column, you can see where IFRS and international standards on auditing fit in. In terms of who does what, the IMF does all the work on policy and data transparency. It sets all the standards in that area. We at the bank have been delegated the task of doing accounting and auditing, corporate governance, and insolvency and creditor rights. And then the other policy areas, which fit into the regulation and supervision for the most part, they can be done, in practical terms, they can be done either by the IMF or the bank or jointly, depending on circumstances. So that's the ROSC program generally. You can see it covers a far broader spectrum of standards compliance than purely on accounting and auditing. But if we look in particular at the area of accounting and auditing, what we're trying to do here is to help countries improve the quality of financial reporting by comparing national standards with IFRS and international standards on auditing, determining the degree of compliance with the applicable standards, and thirdly, and in some ways most importantly, assessing the strengths and weaknesses of the institutional framework for financial reporting in the country, which can be illustrated graphically here. This is a favourite slide at the bank. Several pillars need to be in place to support high-quality financial reporting, as well as the accounting and auditing standards. You need a good governance framework, you need education and training, you need monitoring enforcement, and all the rest of it. And if any one of those is not strong, then you can see the implications across the piece can be quite drastic. Listed out here, you can see the standard structure and content for an accounting and auditing ROSC. I shan't go through this in detail, but again, you see prominently under item 2 the assessment of strengths and weaknesses for the institutional framework for financial reporting. How far have we come? As of June of this year, June 30 of this year, we had completed 120 of these reviews, of which 100 had been published. It is at the discretion of the country that's being reviewed as to whether they want the document to be published or not. Given our mandate, the vast majority of ROSCs are prepared for developing member countries of the bank, but as a one-off, at the request of the UK government, we did complete one here. And what we're seeing in the wake of the financial crisis is growing demand for some kind of instrument that does the same thing in a developed country setting. And we're trying to explore ways of delivering that. So move on now and talk a little bit about what are the results that we're seeing out of what's a pretty substantial body of work. I'll just highlight the global themes first, and then we can drill down into some of those in a bit more detail. Weak professional accounting bodies is clearly an issue for the quality of financial reporting. Translated IFRSs are not available on a timely basis. Inadequate statutory frameworks, I think we see those in around about three quarters of the countries that we've worked in, which are linked with the point at the bottom on weak enforcement regimes. Real challenge in these countries to keep up with the sheer pace of change of standard setting. And then some issues in the SME sector. drilling down into these in a little bit more detail, as I said, the majority of countries, most countries had sought to adopt, adapt, or converge to IFRS, or at least asserted that they had sought to do so, but their efforts to do that had been hampered by statutory frameworks in need of significant improvement, and also by the fact that in a lot of countries there are either no national standards or some really profound gaps between the national standards and IFRS. Financial reporting requirements for SOEs are in need of improvement in a lot of settings, and that's obviously a big deal because in a lot of developing countries it's in the SOE sector where a lot of economic activity goes on. A lot of countries' financial reporting requirements have been developed for tax purposes, and in some cases have been that it's for that purpose that dictates what's required in terms of general purpose financial reporting, which means there's a big gap. And what we see is that the SME sector is poorly served, either by a complete lack of guidance or by requirements that they have to comply with the same requirements as for listed corporations. And it's the jury's still out on the extent to which the SME standard will cater to that particular set of concerns. I talked about capacity constraints in professional accounting bodies. This manifests itself typically as a lack of relevant knowledge and resources. We see licensing requirements are pretty slack. Anyone can call themselves an accountant and not be held accountable. And CPD management we see is either not addressed, or where there are requirements for maintaining CPD, they're not monitored or enforced. Speaking of enforcement, often the weakest element generally tends to be relatively stronger in the financial sector, but it does seem to be an issue across the piece. Compliance with the adopted standards is a major challenge in most countries, and most countries lack an independent audit oversight body. So that's a synopsis of the findings that we've seen from the 120 reviews that we've carried out. In terms of following up on the work that we've done, I think it's fair to say that we've established a really quite substantial body of diagnostic work and findings. But in terms of relative emphasis on that versus implementing reforms aimed at dealing with those findings, the emphasis has been a lot less on the latter. What we aim to do is to work with countries to develop a country action plan to address findings and implement reforms. Often that's not the number one priority, and it can be difficult to get the attention of the authorities to commit the resources in a credible way to moving forward. Where we have done follow-up work, we have seen some significant achievements, but it's not been on a consistent basis across all the countries that we've worked in. In terms of next steps, where we go from here, just some open questions, really. I mean, I think we and this group and the foundation have a shared goal, which is greater global impact of IFRS, and so kind of how do we work more closely together to achieve this? A few possible areas, maybe, you know, we do have this substantial body of data, so sort of putting together an up-to-date database to track IFRS implementation is one possibility. Maybe making better use of the information for compliance monitoring. One thing that is striking is that for, you know, I showed you the slides with all the different sets of standards under the ROSC program, and most of the standard setters have a pretty formalized and structured role in the methodology that's used to assess the compliance with those standards, but I think we do that on a more informal basis with the ISB, and I think we could maybe put that onto a more rigorous and formal platform. So just some ideas there. I think that's it. I'll hand it back to you, Paul.
Thank you, Simon. Questions, comments? Judith.
Simon, thank you for that report. I think it's one of the most interesting reports I've read. It puts in very stark relief, a very clear picture of the challenges being faced by countries that are implementing IFRS. We often hear, and I'm sure the board hears all the time, how difficult it is for some countries to make the changes required by a standard. But I suspect of the 120 countries you've looked at, there's actually very few whose voices are heard at the board, and that there's probably very few represented round this table or actively participating in the exposure draft stage, and I can see you nodding. So my question actually is to the trustees and the board. So Stephen, I think you're the representative. If many of the jurisdictions adopting IFRS genuinely can't keep up with the pace of change, so not us in Australia complaining, because you know we have a well-developed CPD and professional associations, but some of these 120 countries, if they can't keep up with the pace of change at present, what responsibility does that place on the trustees and the board?
Well, it's clearly something that we need to be aware of. But perhaps, Simon, I could ask you, of these companies, how many are SMEs following the SME standard and how many are following full IFRS?
I don't have that at my fingertips, but my sense is that we've been doing this work since 2002, whatever it was. So given how relatively new in those terms the SME standard is, I would have thought it's, for the most part, it's companies that are asserting that they've adopted full IFRS. And as I mentioned, I think there's an open question as to what impact the SME standard will have had in the settings that we've been working in.
I mean, to Judith's point, this council has debated in the past pace of change and number of standards. So I'm not sure there's much more for me to add to all of those previous conversations that we've had.
I just think it's a different quantum of problem for us. You know, pace of change is one thing sitting in Europe, Australia, New Zealand or somewhere where you do have the infrastructure to cope with it. You just may not like the answer, or you may not want to change, or you may not want to put the cost in. Very legitimate reasons, but this is a whole different quantum, and we are all very proud of the fact of the number of countries that have adopted IFRS, but the burden that is being posed on the at the moment still developing infrastructure is something that I think we need to be very conscious of. And I certainly don't have the answer, but I think it is a responsibility on the board and the trustees to think about.
I agree, and this will be something that we'll all have to think about in the coming months and years as we debate agenda proposals. You know, we've got 23 things in the agenda consultation. I've noticed one or two more have been mentioned during this meeting, so that the list is getting bigger. And at some point in the next months, years, you're going to be presented with agenda proposals, and you're going to be asked to provide us with advice as to whether to take these things onto the agenda. And of course, there'll be people that will be looking at these decisions very closely. We talked over lunch that, you know, at some point, I suspect we're going to have an agenda proposal about agriculture. And I'm sure there'll be a delegation from Malaysia and India at the back of this room when you discuss it, because it'll be a very, very important issue for them. And maybe your advice will be, no, period of calm, don't do it, you're putting too much burden on companies. Well, I think they might have a different view. So there's going to be some difficult decisions and difficult advice for you to think about over the coming years.
Judith, I think we'll come back to your point, because it may be as much a case of making sure that jurisdictions understand the deal they're buying into if they're going to claim full compliance with IFRS. And so may not be so much a case of the board imposing burdens on those jurisdictions as rethinking whether it really is overreaching for some jurisdictions to claim full compliance with IFRS, which potentially damages not only them, but everyone else. But yeah, so that, as you know, that's why we're discussing this. I think Kenneth was next, and then Riaz.
Thank you very much, Paul. Look, the short answer to your first question, Judith, is that the last 6 years, the only spokesman for these 120 countries have been Chuck and myself around this table, you know, and we've tried to carry their case. But I think you need to understand, of this 120 countries, the collective entities that report under IFRS would probably make less than 3% of the world's capital market, you know. So financially they're not strong, numerically they're probably quite large. So it's an issue. Simon, thank you very much for presenting the accounting and auditing ROSC. I had back in the early 20s, I had a fair hand in writing this, developing this program. So, no, 2000s. So, we're in.
It's a miracle.
We're in. Come on. See the rejuvenating effects of scuba diving. Look, I'd just like to elaborate on a couple of the extensive coverage of the accounting and auditing ROSC. First of all, one of the things we're finding is that while companies are adopting IFRS, they are really inconsistent in the way they're adopting IFRS in the term of coverage. The good ones actually do limit it only to listed companies on their stock exchange. But I have been in some jurisdiction where IFRS has been the only accounting framework, which has provided impossible burdens for sole traders and farmers. You know, and this has led to considerable confusion and kickbacks against the framework. A lot of people have no idea about SMEs. And where they do know about SMEs, I've had battles telling them that they cannot use the SME standard for listed companies or small financial institutions. So this is the sort of framework that we're living in. To elaborate on the issues about the lack of infrastructure, you know, a lot of these countries, their law does not recognise property rights in the way that IFRS does. There are no financial markets. There's no yield curve upon which to price instrument on. There is no independent or objective valuation industry. You get your valuations by buying them, literally. You know. And there is a direct correlation between the fee and the valuation. An inherent lack of a legal framework, which really impairs the quality of IFRS adoption. The problem is that a country in this framework counts equally with Canada and Australia as an adopter of IFRS. Reinforce Paul's point, you know, we are all damned by the same brush. And so we have a huge, huge responsibility to facilitate an appropriate quality of IFRS adoption. Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks, Ken. Riaz.
Paul, I agree with particularly the point you made about coming from a region where the South Asia region where IFRS is a challenge. The issue, it becomes a challenge not for lack of infrastructure, not for lack of skills. It's, I think, they're approaching it wrong. They're trying to mandate IFRS for a wide group of companies who actually shouldn't be doing it. And this is one of the things that we have been pushing and the regional standard setting group saying, restrict IFRS only for listed companies and public interest entities. For everybody else, go for the SMEs. And if you have a still smaller number, go for a third level of gap, which we are looking at. Now, I think that's where I think the World Bank can have a fair amount of influence, because in countries in this region, the World Bank has quite a significant influence. They often have an office in the central banks of those countries. So they can do some quite more than a gentle nudge to get the countries to try and get some sense into their infrastructure, saying that the IFRS is only should be applied for listed companies and for public interest entities. Everybody else should go SMBs. And I think if they do that, then there'll be better sense and there'll be better better protection to the brand, because as Ken said, in lots of countries that I know of, they just have one gap, and that's IFRS. Pakistan is one example. The only gap they have is supposed to be IFRS. And we know the level of compliance is a disaster. So the issue that with what we're trying to say is that if they can put some pressure on and say, okay, guys, because some of these will require legislation at parliament. Because, for example, take Pakistan example, the dictator at the time, the president, just mandated that IFRS shall be the Pakistan gap. Nobody had a chance of hell of saying how it should be done. So maybe they can, because some of this requires political intervention, to try and get some sense into how, what companies should do. If you do list it in a sensible manner, the skill levels are there for those limited companies to do very good IFRS. So I think that's a role that I would urge Ken and his team to try and see whether they can use their influences to try and get some sense. It'll protect the IFRS brand, overall improve the quality of IFRS compliance.
Thank you. April.
Thank you. Thanks, Simon. Great presentation, and I think the work of the IMF and the World Bank in this area is outstanding, and I encourage you to continue. I don't get any sense that anybody's backing off this initiative. It seems to be producing very positive results. I was going to echo some of what, or say some of the things that Ken said, so I won't repeat those, but to emphasise the fact that even though it's we're here talking about IFRS, the responsibilities on this in this area, of course, are much, much broader on governments, their application, as Riaz says, on the various parts of the bridge pillar picture, which I've seen several times, on education, etc., ensuring that IFAC's properly funded for its compliance program is a key part of it. And the role of the regulator and enforcer, I think, is instrumental. I mean, you talk about the lack of auditor oversight body, and I think in many of these countries, and I think that's a key element. But surprisingly, you didn't seem to focus in on the role of the regulator and of, in particular, I'm thinking also of IOSCO. And in the next steps, while you've definitely, of course, focused here on next steps vis-a-vis this environment, I think inside this environment, the relationship with IOSCO, I think, is particularly critical, because corporates, auditors with the best will in the world, are not able to stand up to an environment where the regulator either has a different view or just simply doesn't care. And typically they come about in some of these smaller countries where there are challenges to governance frameworks, not only in corporates, of course, as we know, but at governmental level. And the concept of enforcement and compliance just has a different level of understanding than we might, some of us in this room might be familiar with. So I would encourage you, and I think it's appropriate, even in the context of the ISB, to add IOSCO to the next steps.
Sandra.
I don't know. It was a great presentation. And I don't know a lot about this review process. So I apologize if this question, maybe others know the answer to the question. But what I'm not clear on is to the degree to which this information is available for investors to understand, the degree to which there are these inconsistencies. Because this is, I mean, I understand the level of investment in these countries is very different, and I understand your role, but some of the, it would seem to me that some of increasing compliance is when there's higher costs of capital applied to those countries because of these sort of, for lack of a better word, deficiencies. And I'm just curious as to sort of how investors access this, you provide it, how is it used in other than in a compliance way, in a true economic investor focused way?
through you, Paul. I mean, the reports are all publicly, well, the ones where the country has agreed to the publication of the final report, they're all available on the IMF website and the bank's website. What I don't think we do is much by way of outreach along the lines that you're suggesting. And that, you know, there are some sensitivities associated with that. I mean, I think if we were to be more kind of proactive in terms of what we did with the information, there'd be some protocols with the country that had been reviewed. And in terms of the reports themselves can be quite brief. The data that is used to produce those reports is more extensive, and I don't think we make that available. I don't think we're in a position to make that available.
So you do these things for your purposes, but and to create improvements in your ability to invest in these countries, or
No, I mean we
or
do the reviews
economic.
at the delegation of the IMF, which runs the program generally, under direction from the Financial Stability Board and the G20. It's not to do with our own lending operations in these countries.
Maybe we should come back to the point that you're raising, Senator, because the next session is a follow-on discussion to our previous discussion on branding, and I think one of the dimensions there is there isn't transparency in the marketplace. How could somebody address that issue, make it readily available information to investors and others, just to say, as a matter of fact, do national standards in this list of countries fully comply with IFRS or not? Yes or no? Required for a list of companies, yes or no? That's not a full response, because then I think that will highlight that quite a few in that list may have nominal compliance, but where we would have significant concerns about the quality of compliance. So, and I think that's sort of what you're getting at, can investors make of this information?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Thank you.
So I think it's important, and we will come to it. Jeff?
Thank you, Paul. My question was along the same lines of sharing the data. I think it was at our last meeting that Paul Pachter of the ISB board had an extensive presentation on the application or implementation of ISB around the world. Have you shared your data with Paul? And also, the chief accountant has a report coming out, I think, addressing implementation, at least of some companies, of IFRS. Has your data been shared with the SEC? Thank you.
It's certainly been shared with Paul. I know colleagues are in regular contact with him. The SEC, I think, had said publicly that it was reviewing some of the ROSCs to inform its kind of oversight of the extent to which IFRS are used internationally. I'm not aware that there's been anything other than use of publicly available documents, but Jim might be able to shed more light on that.
Jerry.
Thank you, Paul. I think there's a, perhaps what I'm going to suggest is a spin on the ball kind of a point, and that is that clearly Jim and his office is reviewing the conformity with IFRS in a number of jurisdictions, et cetera. My inclination to point out here is that we can either view this report as the glass half empty or the glass half full. I'm inclined to look at many of these jurisdictions and say there were no accounting standards in that location at all before IFRS came along. And now, whatever conformity there is to a generally accepted accounting principle, it's more than what there was. And if we want to have a chance at a global regime, then this is the growth process we have to go through. So rather than being a negative for the implementation of IFRS by the U.S., I think we should take a look at this as an opportunity rather than a negative. I just think this is a terrific study, and we should look at the glass half full.
Jerry, I think it's more the transparency of, where are you on that spectrum if you're at a very early stage as opposed to the deluxe highest level. to the naked eye, they seem equal. So, and we'll come back to that, I think.
I fully agree with that. I've listened to discussions at FASB where concern has been raised that in a number of the jurisdictions that purport to use IFRS, that not all are fully compliant. And I'm simply saying that facts like this could be used as evidence of that, or they could be used as evidence of a very positive development.
Jim.
I just wanted to give Sandra a thumbnail. I mean, I picked a country at random, which I'm not going to tell you which country it is. But I went to the World Bank ROSC website, and so for this country it says, gaps exist between the national accounting standards and IAS. The national bodies developed 16 national standards on the basis of IAS. Accounting and reporting for banks and insurance companies are not consistent with IAS. There's a huge amount of information already in existence that helps to answer some of the questions that this council is just asking. Now, I absolutely don't know whether this country claims to have adopted IFRS and be one of the 28 countries that are stated to be IFRS adopters, but it's extremely useful information and very readily readable. This national report is 16 pages long, dealing just with accounting and auditing issues, but it talks about transparency and corporate governance. I can really recommend them. We use them a lot.
Thanks, Jim. Panagiotis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, many thanks for the presentation. That was very interesting. My point is, knowing, of course, the work of the IMF and the World Bank, your role doesn't stop, of course, in observing and assessing the ROSC and the other standards. I mean, you have the Article 4 consultations, etc. My question is, have you been taking any steps further? Because, for instance, for G20 countries, you have the G20 mandate for high-level quality standards. You participate in the FSB, you participate in the G20, etc. So you have the means through which you can pursue improvements. For non-G20 countries, again, you have the means to, let's say, pursue improvement also in accounting and auditing standards. Thank you.
Thank you.
Probably need to refer that question to Ken, because under the bank's mandate we can't do anything directly in the majority of G20 countries, but I think the IMF is a better place to do so.
Right, and to pick up from Simon's point there, certainly my boss sits on the Financial Stability Board in the G20, and before each meeting I prepare a briefing for him about outstanding accounting issues, and the IMF supports the move, as I said yesterday, towards a single set of principle-based, high-quality global accounting standards, which we identify as being IFRS. And we are pushing hard through the G20 for that, and the IASB knows that the G20 and the FSB came back to them, you know, in response to the recent financial crisis, and pushed them for development of standards. But, you know, there is a split between the World Bank and the IMF. The World Bank does the developing countries. My institution does the mature economies, which should be taken into account when you read the summaries of the ROSCs, because the world's not all that that bad. There are some good countries. We also try, and as part of the FSAP programs, of which the ROSC is one element of it, we look at the whole framework of the financial sector architecture and look at payment systems, security regulators, financial markets, and bank. We do the Basel core principles, you know, and so all of these get integrated in the FSAP report and the financial system stability assessment, which is the summary. But it's important to note that all of these initiatives are voluntary, and so it's totally at the discretion of the country which is being assessed as to which of the ROSCs and FSAP reports that they wish to make public. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Simon, for a very interesting presentation, and my senses were by no means finished with this, and, you know, there is information available in various places, but, gee, it's tough to even be aware of it, let alone pull it all together. So I think we're going to continue that conversation. Patrick, did you have a point?
Yes, I just would like to remind you that IOSCO made a recommendation to issuers and auditors to remind them that transparency about the application of IFRS is important. We know that there may be differences in the set of standards that are applied. One example is Europe, where there may be and there is there are differences between standards as published by the ISB and those approved by the European Union. And we asked from issuers and auditors to clarify what those differences are, and if, like in Europe, there is a website where these differences can be understood to make a reference to this website or the source of information where differences can be understood. But I understand from the discussion today that the request is broader than that, and that the request would be for regulators to enforce that in countries that say that they use IFRS, there's a body that enforces this use of IFRS. We do that as market regulators for listed companies coming from third countries and listed in our jurisdictions. We do that in Europe. The SEC does that in the US, etc. Maybe the next step would be to see what could be done for large companies in third countries, but that's a kind of mandate that is quite broader than the one we have right now.
Thank you for that. We did not schedule a break this afternoon, so I'm going to put we have two more sessions remaining. Do members want to take a 5-minute break, or do you want to carry straight through?